This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Coping with the coronavirus pandemic, with its homeschooling, isolation and health concerns, is stressful enough for the abled, but what kind of resources are out there for the disabled in this crisis? Orlando area disability advocates Kyle Johnson, Roderick Thomas, Kathy Matthews and Brittany Pilcher join me for a conversation about how the disabled are navigating the challenges of the pandemic. We're joined by Kyle Johnson. He's the CEO of Lighthouse of Central Florida. Kyle, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me back.
And with him is Roderick Thomas. He's working at the Lighthouse Call Center assisting the DEO with unemployment inquiries. Roderick, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
Also joined on this call by Kathy Matthews. She's on the board of Lighthouse. Her son is visually impaired and she's an advocate for mass transit. Kathy, thank you for joining us as well.
Appreciate your time, Matthew. Thank you.
And Brittany Pilcher, she's the development director with the Center for Independent Living in Central Florida. Brittany, thank you too.
Happy to join you.
Kyle, I want to start with you. You've had to kind of radically rethink the way you guys operate during this pandemic, right? What was some of the things that you had to do differently, and how's that been going over the last couple months now?
Well, Matthew, watching how things were unfolding and the rapid pace of how they were unfolding as the pandemic emerged, we were already doing calls for Department of Economic Opportunity for a little over 3 years. We were actually in a plan to scale down a little bit on the number of people we had on that campaign because of their budget cuts. Historically low unemployment. So, of course, they were trimming back, and we immediately had to pivot and start talking about ramping up. Obviously, we stopped that scale down immediately, and then we ramped up. We're in the midst of ramping up to 50 FTE from 15, so that's roughly 65 people probably. So we had to pivot there, and then we also, we supply medical supplies through our supply chain solutions to the U.S. Defense Logistics Agency for the Combat Lifesaver Kit. And we have a lot of relationships in the manufacturing and distributing of medical items. So we were able to leverage those relationships to gain access to several PPE items that we immediately began selling to local hospitals and to the state of Florida, different agencies throughout the state. So for us at Lighthouse, it was really a two-pronged approach, right, that you have to do concurrently. One, defend yourself. Make sure that all your defenses are in place, that you're financially going to be sound and defended, while at the same time being proactive and looking at how we can leverage our current capabilities to benefit in some way from the situation and to be able to help others. So in this case, Florida's unemployed and our medical personnel on the front line.
Mm-hmm. Roderick, what's that experience been like for you working in that call center?
It's been very well for me because, as a future attorney, I just graduated from law school. One of the reasons why I got into the legal field was because I wanted to help. I wanted to help my community. I wanted to be a blessing. So now being able to work in at the call center, being on the groundwork for those individuals that have been laid off from their job, I've talked to multiple people that have had multiple jobs, and now they don't have income. So now it's just giving me a bigger heart just to serve my community, even as I go forward in my career.
You know, the folks we've talked to at WMFE who have been experiencing these issues with the DEO website and then applying for unemployment, there's a lot of frustration there. So in your role as a call center operator, do you have to sometimes be a little bit of a counselor and kind of just let them talk a little bit as well?
Definitely. For me, that's not necessarily a hard situation because being an older person, I've had life issues. I've had to go on reemployment. I have a family. I got kids and grandkids. So for me, it wasn't hard because I've been in that situation. And one thing I never forget is I try to never forget where I come from, although I know where I'm going. So just being a listening ear to help those individuals in any shape, form, or fashion, I'm more than willing. So I don't have a problem. Because I understand people are frustrated this time. So you just have to put yourself on their side of the foot, which I don't have a problem doing. And just understand and listen. If they're upset now, hopefully at the end of the call, they won't be crying or anything of that nature. Hopefully I'll be able to help them out.
Is it emotionally taxing for you, though, hearing some of these stories?
Yes, sometimes it is, definitely. But I kind of look at it as, but there's so many times where this situation where it's actually benefiting. Like I spoke with an individual one time and they was like, They were out of employment. They had just lost their son and different things of that nature. But she gave me a word of encouragement. She said someone told her one time, listen, it's not the size of the load that matters, but it's how you carry it. So I listened to her story. I was like, wow, you know, that's a wonderful idea and a wonderful mindset to have. So I try to hone in on those good times. So when those bad phone calls come, I just kind of focus on the good things and not the bad times.
Mm-hmm. Kyle, how many people do you have in the call center right now?
Gosh, in the last month and a half, we've added, I want to say 30. So we're probably hovering around 45, 50 total on that campaign. But all together at Lighthouse Works, we will this month, for the first time ever, have 100 or more employees. So we've got a lot more recruiting to go. We're about halfway there on the agents that we need to hire for the call center. We're certainly taking applications, and if any listeners out there are connected to people looking for work, we certainly have plenty of it here.
Kathy Matthews, thinking about mass transit and paratransit, you know, there's probably fewer people needing that right now, I imagine, because we've been in a state where most people have been staying home for the last month and a half, right? But I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what some of those challenges are now and what some of the challenges for folks who are disabled and need access to mass transit might be on the other side of this.
Public transit is really important, whether we're talking about access links, that's paratransit or transit for the disabled, or public transportation. It's really needed because what happens is the essential workers that need to get to work, a lot of them are in low-paying jobs and they need public transit in order to get to work. But the other aspect of that is people that don't have transportation, that may be their only access to get to the grocery store or to get to the pharmacy. And what happens when supplies are limited, the things you need the most are the things that aren't available. So if you're used to walking to the nearest store, because a lot of people try to locate themselves if they don't have transportation and have to use access link to places where they can support themselves without it. But if the restaurant you go to eat every night for dinner is now closed because of coronavirus, you have to figure out something else to do about meals. If you go to the grocery store and they happen to be out of all the things that you particularly need, then you don't really have the option of just getting in your car and driving around until you find what you need, or going to that place that's far away that might have that asset. So it's difficult. And also, if you don't have the buses running and you do walk to the store and you have heavy items, now you've got to find a way to get those home because you're not going to be able to carry them all the way home. So there's lots of different aspects. There's lots of people that depend on public transit. A lot of millennials prefer it. If you ride public transit, you're a pedestrian and or you're a biker. So all of those different modes of transportation are very important to plan, to integrate, to work, to fund, because we really don't have that wide breadth of integration of transportation modes.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Intersection. We're talking about the pandemic and its impact on the disabled. With us, Kathy Matthews. Her son is visually impaired. She's an advocate for mass transit. Also joined by Kyle Johnson, CEO of Lighthouse of Central Florida, and Roderick Thomas, working in the Lighthouse Call Center. Also joined by Brittany Pilcher, Development Director with the Center for Independent Living in Central Florida. Brittany, I'd like to bring you into this conversation. Just kind of thinking about some of the challenges over the last month or so, a lot of folks, whether disabled or not, are now kind of socially isolated. What kind of impact is that having on the folks that you serve?
Here at the Center for Independent Living, we were closed to the public as of March 16th, and it has really pushed us to find alternative ways to connect and meet with our consumers. So typically pre-pandemic, we would have the consumers come to our office. Case managers do intake that way. But unfortunately, with the new pandemic and all the CDC guidelines, we are having to find ways to work around that, which has been very left us to be very innovative through Zoom meetings and video phone, through, of course, email and traditional phone, and helping really navigate the assistance that is out there but specifically for our seniors and people that we serve through our Foundations to Freedom program, where we provide home modifications and adaptive medical equipment so that they can live independently. Now more than ever, we have seen an uptick in the request because people are wanting to feel safe in their home, and we want them to be safe in their home. We do not want them to have any type of fall. We want to prevent them from, you know, having to go to the hospital, the already overload on our hospital system, getting, you know, being in the line of potentially getting the virus, being out that way. So we, while we're not able to use our volunteers like in the past, we are still able to build ramps with our building techs using all CDC guidelines, and able to provide independence that way. Another huge thing that we've seen from our consumers, the people that we serve, just last week, we installed a ramp for a senior citizen in Oviedo, and mm-hmm. she called back the next week, and she was terrified to go. She did not want to go to the grocery store, rightfully so. You know, she's a vulnerable population. She doesn't need to be out there. These are people, they can't afford delivery services like Shipt or Instacart. So she asked us, you know, is there any way somebody can bring us some food items? And so that led us to really thinking about what else can we be doing for our seniors and for those with disabilities during this time. Mm-hmm. We were really fortunate. We partnered with Feeding Florida, one of their partner agencies, the Second Harvest, just recently delivered 150 meal kits to us. And we're able to go bring those to these individuals that are calling us, that are isolated, not able to get out of their homes, as well as cleaning supplies, face masks, just a small portion of that, you know, not anything in large quantities, but gloves, face masks, and just, you know, we're proactively calling our seniors and those and the individuals with disabilities that we serve and see and checking in on them. And how are you doing? And is there anything that we can do right now in this moment that can make you feel safe, make you feel a less isolated and more independent?
Thinking about reopening Brittany, what are your plans for that? Because a lot of businesses are trying to figure that out right now.
So tentatively, we are set to reopen to the public on June 1st. But week by week, we are looking at what is coming down the pipeline. Is it safe? Because we do serve that vulnerable population, people with disabilities and seniors. Is it safe for them to come into our office for their safety, for our staff safety? Like I said, this time has really pushed us to be able to do things differently, whether through video phone, Zoom, phone calls, to still be able to do the services that we do with that limited contact. So in a way, it's been, you know, pushed us out of our comfort zone, but I feel like we are being rewarded and we have a new way of doing things. But we are, you know, hoping to get to open to the public. But like you said, it will have to be in stages and very minimal, you know, prior to closing officially. We were already doing precautions of, you know, pre-screening with the temperature checks and please don't come in if you're sick. And can we do things over the phone? So to answer you honestly, I'm not sure if we will reopen our doors to the public June 1st, but we're still, you know, available via phone, still our same intake system with case management through the phone.
Kathy, I noticed you nodding when Brittany was talking about the fact that isolation is an issue. If you were to, you know, give Central Florida a grade, have we done a good job of taking care of some of those vulnerable communities, and could we do better?
You can always do better. That's kind of an easy question for me. Thank you. But there are a lot of organizations out there trying really hard to make sure that food gets to people that need it. They have people that take care of seniors that are still trying to go, even though it's a little risky. They're going to make sure, because that's sometimes the only contact that these seniors have anymore. I was also going to pivot back to Kyle a little bit, because not only at Lighthouse Works has Lighthouse done an incredible job trying to figure out how to work through this COVID pandemic, but they've also done it for services, because they're also outreach. And at the last board meeting, the head of services was, and Kyle, you can stop me and you can talk if you want, But he was saying that as part of their outreach, because they've had to do a lot of things Brittany's been talking about, instead of going out and meeting with parents of babies and trying to help them figure out how to best raise their children when they're visually impaired or blind, they've had to find different ways to do that. And there's been a lot of Zoom meetings and a lot of calls and a lot of interaction. But what they found out was in doing that interaction, there is a lot of food insecurity is how he worded it, which I thought was a really interesting way. And there's a lot of mental issues. People are having a hard time with this, especially when resources are low and they don't feel like they're have the bare necessities. And so part of what Lighthouse Services is also doing in serving our team, really, is that they're reaching out and finding other services to help them to augment. So when they find this is going on and these people don't really know that there's an opportunity for a free meal or some counseling, Lighthouse is working really hard to connect them with the right services. So part of it is communication. Part of it is just really people knowing where to go and who can help them. And as part of Lighthouse Services, they are doing some of that, which I think is laudable.
Just in the last few minutes we have here, I wanted to talk a little bit about the future on the other side of this, and particularly the funding piece. Kyle, what are some of your concerns about, you know, what not just Lighthouse, but maybe other disability advocates might be facing, given the fact that Florida particularly is looking at a pretty big deficit in terms of funding? And what are some of the things that you're going to be telling lawmakers as you sort of fight to make sure that that the disabled community is not left out when it comes to getting through the other side of this?
Yesterday I sat in on a great community call, likely over 100 people on it. Mark Brewer, the CEO of the Central Florida Community Foundation, talked about the road to recovery and talked about, you know, what we talk about in the sector a lot is about diversification. But Mark yesterday was accurate in saying, if you've not diversified, it's too late. You've got to pivot and understand what you can optimize in your funding strategy moving forward, and to expect philanthropy to take a dip, to see corporate philanthropy take a dip, to see multi-year grants be canceled because the family foundation's money is invested in the market and the market's taken a whack, right? We've seen a bit of this after 9/11. We've seen a bit of this through the recession in 08 and in the years around that. And so I think that it's going to take a lot of careful examination and monitoring. You know, for us, we're doing financial simulations all the time, and we're doing well right now. You know, we are hanging in there, but we're running financial simulations that may be something we don't think would ever happen, but we want to make sure that we're ready if that does happen. We're prepared for that. A big thing, you know, Lighthouse Central Florida relies on contracts with the state of Florida to serve Central Florida's blind and visually impaired, to teach them how to live beyond the restrictions of vision loss and blindness, and philanthropy. Well, here, the reason why we're here, and Roderick works at Lighthouse Works, and Roderick was a client of Lighthouse Central Florida before he came to work at Lighthouse Works. But the reason why this exists is to create competitive careers for people who are blind, because 7 out of 10 nationwide and for decades have been unemployed. We're changing that here in Central Florida, but it's to do that and to generate net revenue we can send to Lighthouse Central Florida. And so, you know, the stronger we make ourselves here, the better our future will be at Lighthouse Central Florida. But in the near term, it's running financial simulations, cost-cutting where you can. Certainly now is not the time to try to throw in a new program. I think right now is the time to validate and demonstrate the real outcomes that your nonprofit is making in the community, not just servicing problems, but helping solve them, and so that and maintaining the relationships with the philanthropic network, be they individual donors or corporations, to help keep those synapses firing, that relationship deepening, so that when we do emerge 18 months, 3 years out, that those relationships are intact and sustainability can still be pursued.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been joined by Kyle Johnson. He's the CEO of Lighthouse of Central Florida. Kyle, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much, Matt. We appreciate it.
Also, Roderick Thomas, working at the Lighthouse Call Center, assisting the DEO with unemployment inquiries. Roderick, thank you as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And Brittany Pilcher, Development Director with the Center for Independent Living in Central Florida. Thanks so much, Brittany.
Appreciate it.
And Kathy Matthews, her son is visually impaired. She's also on the board of Lighthouse of Central Florida. Thank you as well, Kathy.
Thank you for your time, Matthew. Truly, thank you.
Still to come, for some Central Floridians, the pandemic is evoking painful memories of Hurricane Maria. Channel 9 anchor and reporter Nancy Alvarez joins us to talk about the Spanish language information gap in the early weeks of the crisis and the impact of the pandemic on Orlando's Hispanic community. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. For some Central Floridians, the pandemic is evoking painful memories of Hurricane Maria. Anchor and reporter Nancy Alvarez, who hosts the morning show on Channel 9, wrote about the impact of the pandemic on Orlando's Hispanic community for ABC News in an analysis piece titled Spanish Translations Outreach Lacking Amid Coronavirus Pandemic. Nancy, thanks so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So in the piece you wrote for ABC, you articulate the questions and concerns expressed by a lot of Central Florida's Hispanic community, which is why aren't we hearing from the Spanish-speaking commissioners, and where is Police Chief Orlando Rolon in these briefings? I wonder if you could just kind of unpack some of that concern for us.
Yeah, so this conversation among, some community leaders and advocates really started early on during this pandemic. And I have to say that I think the situation has gotten a lot better in many ways. But in those first few days, you know, in the first few weeks, there was just a lot of confusion and just a lot of talk among several people that are involved with the Hispanic community about why things were set up a certain way. For example, we weren't hearing from Spanish-speaking commissioners at those news conferences that we're used to seeing now several days a week in Orange County. And that's very different from what you see, for example, in Miami-Dade County, where those news conferences in South Florida are very much bilingual, and it just sort of flows, and the languages are kind of weaved together. And it's very different here. And, another thing that people were wondering, you know, Orlando Rolon is the chief of the city of Orlando. He's bilingual. John Mina was very effectively communicating the importance of following the rules, if you will, right? Wear the mask, respect the curfew, all these things in English. And a lot of people were feeling like we really needed to hear that in Spanish, and it wasn't happening. And that's just because Orange County was the lead agency to this response for this region. And because of that, John Mina was then the main spokesperson for law enforcement. And that's fine. But a lot of people were raising concerns about whether the Hispanic community was being just a little bit overlooked. And of course, it's so important to say, you know, speaking Spanish is not a job requirement, right, to be sheriff or to be mayor or any job. But we just felt it was important for that message to be, delivered in Spanish just as importantly as it was in English.
You talked about the fact that things have improved, and the county briefings, for example, they've started to do a recap in Spanish at the end. But does it kind of feel like it's a bit of an add-on? Are you getting the full benefit of everything that's been said in English leading up to that?
Well, you know, that's sort of the point of why I wrote the article, and I'm so grateful it was shared sort of on a national level, because, I mean, we're just sort of a small slice, right, of America and of the bigger picture. And there are communities all over this country with Hispanic communities that are just exploding like ours, right? I mean, that 32822 zip code that was a hot zip, right, for so long during this pandemic, I mean, they're at least 60% Hispanic. So this is really just about emergency management and public safety and being proactive and not reactive and understanding your community, you know, even pulling out a map, looking at this zip code, saying, okay, wow, we need to get information to this zip code in Spanish now, not in 4 weeks or 5 weeks or 6 weeks, but, you know, from the beginning, from day one. So that was really the point of me writing that article, is just to raise some awareness about this, that it shouldn't be reactive, it should be proactive, and it should be part of the emergency planning from day one, for the sake of public safety and the wellness of everyone in our whole community.
Do you still think we need to see Police Chief Orlando Rolon up on stage during these briefings saying, you know, if not talking about law enforcement, at least kind of talking about some of the other things that people might be asking about?
Yeah, well, I mean, he has been out there. I mean, he did an interview with me in Spanish that I shared on social media. I would I would think that, you know, the better, the more the better, right? The more the better, especially as we start to reopen the economy and people, you know, slowly start to come out. If there is a very important message that needs to be sent about wearing masks, for example, if that's going to be enforced in any way as we start to reopen, that message needs to be sent very strongly in Spanish, just as it is in English. And whether that comes from Orlando Rolón or the commissioners, I mean, there are two commissioners on that board that speak fluent Spanish. It all needs to be addressed because this community is huge here now. And I think the most important thing that people need to remember is that this isn't about, you know, oh, speak Spanish. I know this is America. Speak English. We always hear that, right? And I understand that and I respect that completely. But we are in a community that has thousands of families that are in transition. So what does that mean? That means that they've been here 2 years or less, 3 years or less. I mean, Hurricane Maria was 2017. These are families that are still transitioning into their new language. So they are learning and they are trying, but they haven't fully mastered it yet, for one, or two, they're nervous, they're scared, they're confused. And perhaps hearing the message and the rules in Spanish would just help them assimilate it more, help them follow everything more. And again, I can't say it enough. I mean, this is in the best interest of all of us because we're all going to the same stores. Our kids are all in the same schools. And it's just very important that everyone gets the message equally.
I guess part of the other concern too is that this thing isn't over, right? I mean, we're past the peak of the first part, at least, of this pandemic. But there are still some fears that we could be facing another peak, if not in winter, maybe before then. And the predictions for the impact of this disease in terms of how many people infected, you know, the death toll, that keeps changing. So it's a little hard to gauge exactly how bad this thing could still be down the track. And when you think about some of those zip codes, those hot zips, as you mentioned, you know, the need for getting good information into those areas is still going to be there.
It's so vital. And especially now that we are talking about reopening and we are moving into these phases, we're just in phase one. But here's a perfect example. We're looking at the phases and we're asking the question, okay, when do we reopen the tourist corridor? When do we open the theme parks? Well, vast majority of workers in tourism live in 32822. So if they're not healthy, if they're not informed, then that connects to the reopening, right? It's all connected. We are woven together in this community. One depends on the other very much. And the sooner, you know, companies, leaders understand that, the better we'll be. And I think many are. I think they're getting it. But I think the information component is important. I mean, I know that, like, for example, some major companies are making donations to food pantries in 32822, for example. That's huge. That's helpful. It's important. People feel seen, you know, when major companies do that. But again, it's the information that is important, and it's especially important that in certain pockets of our community, it's given to them in the way that it'll be most effective, which for many is Spanish.
You mentioned Maria, Hurricane Maria, just a moment ago, talking about families that have moved from Puerto Rico fairly recently and still adjusting to life in Central Florida. I'm wondering, too, whether this pandemic might be bringing some PTSD to the surface from folks still kind of grappling with the trauma of that event as well.
Thank you for asking me about that, because the trauma is so real for these families. Imagine being a kid, okay? And you and I have kids. I mean, our kids go to the same school. And imagine having, you know, a 9-year-old and your child is in school in Puerto Rico. And then there's a hurricane and the school closes. And you don't know what we're going to do. We don't know what we're going to do. We're going to stay put. Maybe we'll start a new school. And then there's an earthquake.
Yeah, I forgot to mention the earthquake. There's that too.
And then, okay, well, then let's go stay with our family in Central Florida, right? Because now the ground is shaking here and we don't feel safe. And then you get here and now there's a pandemic and your school just closed again. So this is the reality for many, many families. Many children who, for example, came after Maria, the rest of the family stayed in Puerto Rico, and then these are kids are hearing about their grandparents in earthquakes. I mean, even if they're here and they're safe since Maria, you know, these families got split, right? Where half stayed in Puerto Rico and half came here. The trauma is so real, and that's yet another reason. If you came here 3 years ago, maybe you've managed to learn English or you've mastered it. Maybe you knew it. There's a lot of people in Puerto Rico speak English already. But these people are traumatized, and they're scared and they're confused, and it would just be helpful and more effective to receive information in Spanish on where we go from here.
Mm-hmm. You've done some things at WFTV too to sort of increase the level of coverage in Spanish, right? I wonder if you just talk quickly about what you've done to try and make sure that you're getting information out to the community.
Yeah, my contribution is really coming from that social media aspect of all of this and understanding that people, like I said, aren't always just, you know, sitting around at 5 o'clock ready to watch the news. And so I've just started a small, short brief in Spanish, and I post it every day. And it's just I do the morning news on Channel 9 from 5 to 9 a.m. And then around 9:30, we just do sort of a shortened, very shortened version of the morning show, maybe take the top three or four headlines or stories, and we record them in Spanish. And then I post them on social media, and then they're shared on a page on WFTV.com that is fully in Spanish. And then we have a Spanish blog that we maintain as well. So it's just another option, you know, that we have put out there for people who want the information when they want it, that can't really rely on being in front of the TV at 5 or 6 or 11 at night. It's there in Spanish if people want it on WFTV.com and on my Facebook page, Nancy Alvarez, WFTV.
Nancy Alvarez is an anchor and reporter with Channel 9 WFTV in Orlando. She hosts the morning show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, my friend. We'll see you again soon, I hope.
Still to come, hospital chaplain Edwin Alicia talks with 90.7 health reporter Abe Abaraya about the challenge of ministering to the sick amid social distancing. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Edwin Alicia has a simple belief as a hospital chaplain: no one should die alone. That isn't easy when hospitals are putting restrictions in place to stop the spread of COVID-19. 90.7 health reporter Abe Abaraya spoke with Alicia, who's the director of mission and ministry at Advent Health Orlando.
Walk us through your last shift. You know, what was the last shift like for you?
I just came from speaking with a few nurses. I was just going in there. One of them tapped at the window. There was no one outside, and they needed some materials. So right away, I became the helper, and I love doing that. I just love being useful in there. So I went and got some of the things, and then they told me, not this one, it's a different one. So I went to one of the nurses. They said, okay, this is the right sponge. So they gave everything to me, and then I went and gave it to them. And they throw kisses to me, and I throw kisses to them. I happen to be with just a physician that I respect a whole lot. And it happened that right in the beginning of the crisis, when it was just barely starting and families were still able to come to this unit, and things were changing so rapidly, we had just gotten a patient, and you know, it was what we call a PUI, patient under investigation. They are doing the testing. They don't know, that they suspect, but they don't know. And as a physician is out there with a family explaining to what she is assessing, right in the middle of it, the patient vomits inside the room and codes. It goes into a cardiac arrest. Without any hesitation, this woman throws her PPE in a matter of seconds. Throws her PPE on and just rushes as she screams code blue. And everything now is flooding to that room, and the family, which we always respect, if the family wants to see a code, we do not move them away. We respect, because sometimes it allows them to take better decisions about what is happening. So the family, you know, she just put the bed flat and cleared up the airways with all the vomiting that was happening, and she just started doing compressions herself. You know, no hesitation, no mercy, not waiting for the right person to do the compressions, and just kept on doing. The rest of the team kept on putting all the PPE on, and then just flooding into the room, and then now she, you know, steps away from over the body. And now other people, and then she starts orchestrating the whole thing. It took about maybe 30 minutes, 20 to 30 minutes. That woman did not move from there. No RT, no nurse moved from that place. They were going for a life. And that life was precious. And they got him back. And as they got him back, and things are stable now, in the meantime, the family had asked me, can you pray with us? And yes, I prayed with them. I wanted to know exactly where they were standing in as far as the condition of the loved one. Are they expecting him or her to make it? Are they aware that maybe this is the end of it? I just want to know where they are standing. And the doctor steps out, and as the doctor steps out, the family just burst out in tears. And now they're just saying, we are so sorry. We are so sorry, doctor. And this woman almost like grabbing her own hands because she cannot embrace. Almost like grabbing her own hands. Said, it is okay. Everything is going to be okay. They just can't stop saying, I'm sorry, doctor. We are so sorry. I said, it's going to be okay. I might just have to be in quarantine, but that's going to be it. Let's talk about your loved one. And this woman, who looks like she just came from the gym and a workout, you can see the cheeks, a little bit of the cheeks that you can see them red, and her eyes still on fire with a level of peace, Abe. It was beautiful. It was just beautiful. And here I'm standing and I'm saying to myself, wow, that's my physician.
There have been several healthcare workers who have unfortunately killed themselves in the New York area. How are the healthcare workers you're dealing with kind of coping? How are they sort of dealing with everything?
It's hard to see them crying. Especially when they see patients dying alone. They are not, you know, our ICU's families stay there. Families sleep there. Unless it is an airborne situation, they sleep there. So we are used to see them holding hands, not to be alone. So that is one of the, I think is one of the torturers that is happening. One of the things that the hospital has been very intentional right from the get-go is to team up with our social workers, licensed social workers, the chaplains, creating two teams for creating strategies of how to prevent and protect and detect any early signs of micro trauma that can become a big trauma. So we have, at the hospital, our leaders have been very intentional, and I've been part, I'm part of one of, you know, one of those teams. And it is beautiful to see what they have done to create a respite room for them to relax. And I just went up a moment ago, I saw four nurses, they were in different places. One of them was, we have a massage chair, and she was just enjoying the different positions. And the rest was just laughing. And just the fact that, you know, they can come out and do that and have these small moments. And the other thing that we have done is a couple of the chaplains, three of us, we go into the unit and we check on them. And I want them to know that I'm checking on them. And I tell them, I'm checking on you. How are you today? To see a young nurse telling me the one on the left doesn't know that his wife just died. The one on the right, she doesn't know that her mom just died. And after she tells me the story, then I have this chance of saying, and how are you doing? And sometimes there are tears flowing down. I said, not good. this is going to be a hard wake up. So just sometimes this anticipation of what they are waking up to is hard on the nurses. I do see a lot of beautiful spirit inside the unit and a lot of teamwork. Just like it happened today, you know, the nurse stepped away, the one that was outside, and I happened to become the helper, which I loved. And just this teaming up, and there's a tablet inside the room, and there's a tablet outside the room, and they're writing to each other. So, and they're communicating with each other because they're minimizing the things that they have to clean up. So there's this, and, you know, just giving a thumbs up, yeah, running for the things and coming back. And then, you know, if I happen to be going through the unit sometimes, just bringing chocolate, something. And I show it to the ones that are inside. And they start throwing kisses. And they throw kisses back. So it is a tough environment, but at the same time, it is an electrifying environment. It is a positive environment. Nurse leaders are on top of things. Checking on everything that is happening in the room. And if something is not happening, you can hear the tap right away, and the nurse is going for the window. So there is this accountability and this mutual protection in which they're checking on each other all the time.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edwin Alessia. He's a chaplain at Advent Health Orlando. I've had doctors and nurses describe chaplains to me as sort of problem solvers. And I'm wondering, what are some of the things you have been able to problems you have been able to solve in this very difficult, challenging time?
Like I told you, some of these patients are waking up and to the reality, the sad reality that someone died. So I need to prepare the nurse for what is going to be happening. We have a patient experience team or clinical experience team, which are nurses, graduate nurses as well. And they are the ones that are going into the room with a Chromebook to allow for the conversation. And as I spoke with the family want to be the one that breaks the news. They feel that they owe it to their sibling and the husband that they want to break the news. And so I run through them about exactly what are you going to say. And after they tell me what they're going to say, then I tell them, this is what you're not going to say. You're not going to say, don't cry. You're not going to say, it was God's will. You're not going to say, there's people suffering more than us. You will not say that. If he curses, let him curse. If he cries, let him cry. If he gets angry, let him get angry. But do not dare offending him, trying to understand where he's standing right now as you are slamming him with a 2x4 in the face. So I prepare them. I sit with a nurse as I'm preparing her. I notice that she's just tearing up and tearing up until she finally tells me, Edwin, who is going to hold his hand? Who is going to be in that room with him? And she just walks away. And I'm saying, okay, we're going to let her come back. She cried for a few minutes, came back, said, I'm so sorry, Edwin, I'm so sorry, but this is too painful. Who is going to be with him? So it was a big debate. They were going to prepare me so I could go in. Infectious disease told me, we'll prep you up. And then one of my leaders said, Edwin, don't do it. Do it for me. Don't do it. You got the glass. It's just a few feet away. Stay out here. Let them talk. And so we debated for a while, and just to, so my nurse leader does not lose it because she's caring for me. He said, it's okay, I'm going to be out here. So I stay out, and I am now in the conversation. And after the conversation, then I call and I start processing with the patient. And there was a lot to process. a lot to process. And after, then I check with my nurse, and now I start talking with her, and I ask her, when you started crying, what went through your mind? She leans back, she tears up again. See my parents. They have the same age as them. And now she can put the finger and she can name the source of pain. Once you name it, it's out here. Once you name it, it's shared between the two of us. And we process a little bit about it. I don't try to bring a solution about it. I don't try to explain anything, how she should be stronger and it's not happening with her parents. I just ask kindly, how are they doing? They are well, Edwin. They are doing really well. Yeah, but normally, not as problem solvers, no. And sometimes when they are not with us and they are not in the room with us, they imagine what we do. And if they have not interacted with the chaplain, you get to imagine what the role of the chaplain. The chaplain is here to pray.
I was going to say, I mean, how are you sort of handling this very different job where you aren't able to physically interact with a patient or with, you know, just the social distancing in a time when people obviously just really crave physical touch?
It's hard. It's very hard. Is normally, even if the family chooses not to be in the room, we are in the room. We believe in no one dying alone, and we are still trying to practice that during this time. It may be with a nurse or two in the room, but we try to practice it. It's hard. I respect it, but it's difficult. It's difficult.
You mentioned that, you know, you deal with people who, you know, as a chaplain, you have people of different faiths, you have people with no faith. I'm wondering, is there a particular passage or something that you, you know, that resonates well with people who maybe don't have religion or don't, you know, don't have as much faith?
Honestly, if they don't, I will not use it. No. I respect where they are at. And sometimes we have had patients. I had a patient in one occasion. He was completely not religious, to the point that when he, and it was a long, long journey for this patient. He went home for the first time after 200 and I don't know how many days. And so he had to come back. He had to go home, came back. And one day he called me to the room and he told me, you know, I need to tell you something. Because every time he would come, he would ask for me. And I would always be there. And so he told me, and the week that the voice sounded so weak. That day he said, Edwin, I'm not giving up, but I think I'm losing this battle. Can you do something for me? I don't want to put this on my wife. I don't have any other religious friend. Can you do my funeral? He said, yes, sir, I can do your funeral. And you're going to tell me what you want me to do in your funeral. He told me the details. I got together with music therapy. We have music therapy. We chose his most favorite music. And that's what we played in the funeral. And I told stories. Some of the family members said that they were a little bit afraid about the stories I was going to be telling. But it was a beautiful experience. So just to respect the humanity of the person and just to journey with them exactly where they are at, that is an honor. And that's what chaplains do all the time.
And that was Edwin Alessia, the Director of Mission and Ministry at Advent Health Orlando, talking with 90.7's Abe Abariah about ministering to the sick during the coronavirus pandemic. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne, production assistance for today's show from Abe Abariah. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners and from Advent Health. There are a lot of things that people need right now, and information is one of them. Donating to WMFE is an easy way to support the news you and so many others rely on. Give back now. Visit WMFE.org to get started. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.